A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The 1306 expulsion of Jews from France. You learn it as Philip the Fair's decree. The king needs money, seizes Jewish property, kicks everyone out, done. But that's about 20% of the story. The rest runs through the queen's chamber. Where did they lean the other way? Under church pressure. And then there's the fascinating divergence in the Low Countries, where women ruling in their own right produced a completely different pattern of Jewish settlement. He wants the economic texture, not a survey. So, where do we even start?
The 1306 expulsion. That's where everyone starts, and that's the problem. It's always told as Philip IV's story. The debt, the Templars, the king running out of money and seizing Jewish assets before kicking them out. And that happened. But the scaffolding for that moment? It was built over 2 centuries by queens who held the purse strings and the petition rights that kept Jewish communities viable in the first place. Yet when you trace the actual decisions that determined whether Jewish moneylenders stayed or went, whether they wore the badge or didn't, whether a bishop could expel them from a town or got blocked, you keep finding a queen's hand.
Because the expulsion wasn't just a king's decision, it required the removal of a structural obstacle.
And that obstacle was Jeanne of Navarre. But we'll get to her. The point is, we're in this moment right now where scholars are digging into gendered governance and minority economic integration in ways that completely reframe how we read medieval power. And this episode is basically the medieval prehistory of that whole dynamic. I want to name our debt here before we dive in.
Before we dive into the specific queens, let's lay out what we're actually talking about when we say queenly power in this period. Because it's not ceremonial.
She works on exactly these intersections, power, gender, and minority experience in Jewish-Christian relations in medieval Europe, including French queens and Jewish communities up to the 1306 expulsion and the early Dutch Jewish settlement patterns in the late medieval Low Countries. Her work is the reason we're having this conversation in this shape, and listeners should absolutely seek it out. vanleer.org.il. She controlled taxation, justice, and settlement rights in those territories. She could say Jews may live and lend here, even if the king's policy was moving in a different direction.
A dower wasn't a gift the king could revoke. It was legally hers.
Which is why we see queens using dower lands as safe havens. Third, household economies. Queens ran independent financial networks. They had their own treasuries, their own revenue streams, their own credit relationships. I did not know that. Fourth, patronage of religious institutions. Queens could fund monasteries or bishoprics, and those institutions could then pressure or protect Jewish communities depending on the queen's interests.
The queen's relationship with Jewish communities wasn't about philosemitism. It was about revenue.
These were economic relationships structured through the legal category of serfs of the chamber, servi camerae. Jews in France were legally the property of the crown or the local lord. That sounds terrible, and in many ways it was, but it also meant they had a direct legal relationship with the ruler. If the ruler needed their lending services, they got protection. If the ruler didn't, they were vulnerable. The first and most concrete is dower lands. When a medieval French queen married, she received a dower, land set aside for her income and maintenance, which she held in her own right, separate from the crown.
Let's set the timeline. We're talking roughly 196, the First Crusade, through 136, 2 centuries where Jewish status oscillated between royal protection and periodic localized expulsions, and the queens are often the buffer.
This created a parallel jurisdiction where the queen could protect Jewish communities even when royal policy was turning hostile. Those are softer levers, but they're real, and Jewish communities were exactly the kind of site where those levers got pulled. Because Jewish money lending was woven into the domestic economy of the court in ways that other economic activities weren't.
We should name the scholar whose work really opened up this framing, Hannah Schachter. She goes by Teddy, is a research fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute, and her scholarship on the intersections of power, gender, and minority experience in medieval Jewish-Christian relations is the direct inspiration for this episode's approach. She's done deep work on French queens and Jewish communities up to the 36th expulsion, and on early Dutch Jewry in the late medieval Low Countries. If listeners want to follow the academic thread, her work is well worth seeking out.
And what her research shows, along with others in this space, is that we can't understand the pattern of medieval Jewish settlement just by looking at kings and church councils. The queen could petition the king. This sounds soft. It is soft in the sense of not being formal authority. But in a personal monarchy where the king's will was law, access to the king's ear was power, Jewish communities understood this perfectly.
Let's start with the first of our four queens, Adelaide of Maurienne, roughly 192 to 1154, wife of Louis VI, regent during Louis VII's crusade from 1147 to 1149. What makes her the right starting point?
If she took up their cause, she could shape royal policy without ever issuing a decree of her own. In sense, Jewish moneylenders operated under her direct protection, and they paid her a specific tax, the Talia Judorum, the Jewish tallage. The effectiveness of each lever depends on one variable, how much independent fiscal resource the queen controls. A queen with rich dower lands and her own revenue streams has real bargaining power.
That's not trivial.
It's significant, and we know this from tax records that survive from her household administration. During Louis VII's absence on crusade, Abbot Suger, who was running the kingdom as regent alongside Adelaide, tried to restrict Jewish lending. Adelaide overruled him. Not because she had some ideological commitment to protecting Jews, but because her household budget was built on that 60-lever revenue stream. If the Jews of Seine stopped lending, her income dropped.
Centralization eliminated them.
That's the tension that runs through the whole two centuries. Queens were, in practice, the best protectors Jewish communities had in medieval France. But the protection was always conditional on the queen's fiscal calculus. When the math changed, when dynastic pressure or ecclesiastical politics outweighed the economic benefit, the protection vanished. The 1306 expulsion didn't come out of nowhere.
Which brings us to the most powerful case in the French context, Blanche of Castile, 1188 to 1252. Regent for Louis IX from 1226 to 1234, and then again from 1248 to 1252 during the Seventh Crusade. Let's walk through the cases. The earliest documented intervention by a French queen on behalf of Jews comes from Adelaide of Maurienne, queen consort to Louis VI, and it's not a story about piety or tolerance. It's a story about grain.
Right, and before we get to that grain, let's unpack the framework. When I say three levers, we need to be precise about what they actually are, because shaping Jewish life sounds vague unless you can point to the mechanism. Louis IX's crusade was partly financed through loans from Jewish bankers, and Blanche personally guaranteed those loans. The crown's crusade budget ran through her intercession. The dower lands are the cleanest lever. When a queen received her dower upon marriage, she became the direct lord of those territories. She held court, she issued charters, she collected revenues.
That pressure produced the 1234 ordinance.
The king's authority didn't reach there directly. But here's the thing, it kept lending legal. It was a compromise. The church wanted outright prohibition. Blanche couldn't do that because she needed the credit. So she squeezed the margins but preserved the mechanism.
The gendered mechanics here are really specific. Blanche couldn't raise taxes by fiat to fund a crusade. She couldn't wage war to seize assets. So she used her intercessory role to broker between the church and Jewish financiers, protecting the lending system while conceding enough on interest rates to keep the ecclesiastical pressure at bay.
The second lever is the household economy, and this one is less visible but maybe more important day to day. The queen's household wasn't just a domestic unit. It was a major economic enterprise. It purchased grain, wine, cloth, luxury goods. It employed physicians. And it needed short-term credit constantly, because revenues came in seasonally, but expenses were year-round.
That's where Jewish moneylenders enter.
Canon law prohibited Christians from lending at interest, which meant the entire credit market in 12th and 13th century France ran through Jewish lenders. The queen's household contracted with them directly. We're talking about loans at 40 to 60% interest, secured against future tax revenues from the Queen's own estates. This made the Queen a direct stakeholder in the survival and prosperity of Jewish lending networks.
Which sets up the contrast with our third queen, Marguerite of Provence, 1221 to 1295, wife of Louis IX, but politically sidelined by Blanche during Louis' reign. Her power came later.
Marguerite is the Dowager Queen case. During Louis's reign, Blanche ran the show. Marguerite was marginalized, but after Louis died in 1270, Marguerite held the county of Provence as her dower, and there she reversed Louis's anti-Jewish policies. 100%. And the third lever, intercession, is where this gets political. The queen couldn't issue royal decrees, but she could petition the king. In a personal monarchy where the king's will was law, access to his ear was genuine power.
The charter's language is revealing.
She could block, delay, or soften royal action simply by making the case in private. She was saying, "Jewish lending is useful to my treasury, so I'm bringing them back." This is a direct example of a dowager queen using territorial jurisdiction to create a safe haven that contradicted her late husband's policies.
Louis IX was famously anti-Jewish in his later reign. He supported the burning of the Talmud in Paris in 1242. He expanded the enforcement of Lateran IV. And his widow, within 2 years of his death, is issuing charters that effectively undo his approach in her territories.
Blanche of Castile had peak power because she was regent for a child king. She was effectively the sovereign. Marguerite of Provence had far less room to maneuver because Louis IX centralized authority away from the queen's household. And Jeanne of Navarre. She's the most complicated case, because she was a queen regnant in her own right in Navarre, while also being queen consort in France.
The arc runs from fragmented authority where queens had space to operate, to centralized monarchy where that space kept shrinking.
Which is exactly why the Low Countries produce such a different pattern. In Flanders and Hainaut and Brabant, you got fragmented lordships where female rulers needed Jewish credit networks to finance trade, and they had the independent authority to grant durable charters of protection.
What did the charter do?
Centralization eliminated them. He needed money, and he was squeezing Jewish communities to get it. Jean said no. In her territories, her Jews were not paying Philip's tax.
She was in direct conflict with her husband's policy.
The 1304 Troyes Charter is a direct assertion of dower jurisdiction against royal fiscal demands. Philip was moving toward expulsion. He needed the money from seizing Jewish assets to pay his debts, and he was under pressure from segments of the church and nobility to remove the Jews entirely. This is where the fiscal mechanics get concrete. Adelaide's household needed grain. Grain had to be purchased, transported, stored, all of which required cash up front.
Then she died in 1305.
Within a year, the expulsion happened. Philip moved fast. The implication is hard to miss. Jean was the structural obstacle. Her dower lands were a safe haven. 40 to 60% annualized was standard for crown and noble borrowing in this period.
That reframes the whole expulsion narrative. It's not just Philip IV needed money and hated Jews. It's that the political economy of the Capetian court had, for two centuries, included queens as counterweights to royal policy. Jeanne was the last of those counterweights. When she died, the balance collapsed.
The documentary record supports this. We have the 1304 charter. We have Philip's expulsion edict of 1306. The gap between them is barely 2 years. And in that gap, the only thing that changed structurally was that Jeanne of Navarre was no longer alive to enforce her dower protections.
That's the Capetian picture. Queens as protectors and regulators within a royal framework, using dower lands, intercession, and household economics to maintain Jewish lending because their own budgets depended on it. But what happens when you remove the king entirely? That's where the Low Countries come in.
This is the earliest documented case we have of a French queen using dower authority to override ecclesiastical pressure on Jewish residency. 1138, Adelaide of Marienne, Pontoise. Not a footnote. Countesses like Joan of Constantinople, who ruled Flanders from 1205 to 1244, and her sister Margaret II, who ruled from 1244 to 1278, weren't consorts or regents. They were sovereigns. They had full fiscal and jurisdictional authority. Blanche is in a completely different league. She's regent for Louis IX from 1226 to 1234. The king is a child. She is effectively the sovereign of France.
The dynamic shifts from influence to direct rule.
not through Dowerlands, not through intercession, directly. This is a direct contractual relationship between a female sovereign and a Jewish community. No mediating layer of king, no church council approval, no parliament negotiation.
4% versus 2%. That's a market signal.
This isn't a new idea. The Fourth Lateran Council had mandated distinctive dress for Jews back in 1215, but enforcement in France had been patchy. The Council of Rouen wanted Blanche to make it mandatory. The economic incentive to relocate is obvious, and that's exactly what happened over time. Jewish settlement gravitated toward territories with female sovereigns who offered better terms.
Margaret II went even further.
And Blanche's motivation was completely fiscal. She was financing the Albigensian Crusade in the south, which required enormous amounts of liquid capital. Jewish moneylenders were the crown's primary source for that, forcing them to wear a humiliating badge, driving them out of commerce, making them targets. That's bad for business. This is the kind of protection that Capetian queens like Blanche could never offer, because they were operating within a royal framework where the church had independent legal standing.
The structural difference is that sovereign countesses could simply override church authority in their territories, while Capetian queens had to negotiate with it.
This wasn't unusual. Jewish physicians were sought after by noble households across Europe, but having a Jewish physician meant she had a direct line to Jewish communal networks. She knew what the economic impact of the Ruelle would be because she could ask someone who understood the community from the inside. They weren't just tolerating Jews. They were actively recruiting them with favorable charters because Jewish lending provided credit for trade, for urban development, for the wool industry that was making Flanders rich.
When Philip IV expelled the Jews from France in 1306, the Low Countries became the obvious refuge.
Blanche can't openly defy her adult son, the king. That's not how Capetian family politics works. This created a second wave of Ashkenazic settlement in the Low Countries, distinct from the earlier Rhineland migration of the 11th and 12th centuries. The gender dimension here is stark. The expulsion was a king's policy, her dower lands in the Loire Valley.
That refuge pattern shaped the character of Dutch Jewry for centuries. The smaller communities, the greater integration into local economies, the less ghettoized settlement pattern, all of that can be traced back to the protective charters issued by female rulers in the 13th century.
There's a direct line from Joan of Constantinople's 1220 Ghent Charter to the relative stability of Jewish life in the Low Countries through the late medieval period. They followed the protection. Jewish settlement patterns in the 1230s and 40s track directly onto Blanche's dower lands. This isn't random migration, it's strategic relocation to the one jurisdiction where the queen's authority could shield them from the king's piety.
Then Marguerite of Provence walks into exactly the opposite situation. Where Blanche had been sovereign in all but name, Marguerite marries Louis IX in 1234, the same year he's tightening the screws on usury, and she inherits almost none of the independent authority her mother-in-law wielded.
Louis centralized power away from the queen's household deliberately. He was building the apparatus of Capetian monarchy, royal courts, royal administrators, royal revenue collectors, and the queen's household was not going to be a competing power center.
The parchment trail tells a story, if you know where to look. Adelaide sends tax records around 140, Blanche's 1234 interest rate ordinance with her seal on it. She finds a different lever. And then, across the border, Joan of Constantinople's 120 Ghent Charter at 4%, Margaret II's 1242 Douai Charter blocking church arrests. These aren't abstract dynamics. They're specific documents with specific terms and specific economic consequences.
What's striking is how consistent the economic logic is across all of them. None of these women were acting out of religious tolerance in the modern sense. They were protecting revenue streams. The Jewish tax and cents funded Adelaide's household. She petitions Louis to exempt Jewish communities in her Provençal territories, and he grants it. Now you've got this bizarre jurisdictional patchwork. Jews expelled from Paris and the Île-de-France relocating south to territories held by the queen, where they can continue lending under her protection. It's not a safe zone within France, it's a safe zone at the edge of France, and it worked precisely because Provence was Marguerite's, not the crown's.
She wasn't done. The 1259 reversal, Louis allowing Jews back into royal domains under strict conditions, that was partly brokered by Marguerite's negotiations with the papacy. She's working the ecclesiastical channel while her husband is trying to be the most Christian king in Christendom. 18th century German principalities, where princesses and duchesses maintained Jewish court factors against pressure from guilds and church authorities. The medieval pattern doesn't disappear. Which brings us to the most complicated case in the whole picture. Jean of Navarre.
Jean is the one who makes the pattern unmistakably clear, because she's two different rulers in two different polities at the same time. In Navarre, she's the queen regnant, the sovereign. She issues the 1298 Charter of Pamplona, which explicitly protects Jewish communities from the Inquisition's reach. This is a ruler protecting her fiscal base. Navarre's Jewish moneylenders were essential to her independent revenue, and she defended them with the full authority of her crown. In France, she's queen consort to Philip IV. Philip the Fair, and when he expels the Jews from France in 1306 and confiscates their property, Jean's household accounts show she received a portion of the seized assets.
We haven't even touched on the other side of the ledger. The moments where queens leaned into persecution under ecclesiastical pressure, or where their protection was withdrawn when the fiscal calculus shifted. That's the cold calculus laid bare. Same queen, same Jewish communities, different political arithmetic.
In Navarre, protecting Jews served her fiscal autonomy. In France, dynastic solidarity with Philip's centralization project paid better.
In 1932, astronomers observing from the Gobi Desert recorded the largest observed lunar libration in latitude. The moon's north pole tilted nearly 10 degrees toward Earth, exposing a sliver of the lunar far side never before mapped by human instruments.
The Gobi Desert seems like an improbable place for a lunar observatory.
It does, but the atmospheric conditions in the Gobi are actually exceptional for astronomical observation. Low humidity, high altitude, minimal light pollution in the interwar period. There was a German-Soviet expedition.
Of course there was.
And they needed Jewish credit networks desperately.
The cloth trade.
Flanders in the 13th century is the textile powerhouse of Northern Europe. Ghent, Bruges, Ypres, these cities are running on credit. Wool has to be imported from England, dyed, woven, finished, exported to markets across the continent. Every step requires capital up front, and revenues come months later. Canon law still prohibits Christian lending, so the entire credit infrastructure runs through Jewish moneylenders.
Countess Jean of Flanders sees this and acts.
12? 10. Decades before any French queen issues comparable protections, Jean grants Jews charters of protection in Ghent and Bruges. These aren't grudging toleration. These charters include rights to own synagogues, to employ Christian servants, and to operate moneylending businesses without the servi camere status that made French Jews legally the king's property. That last point is the structural difference.
Second, dower lands. When a Capetian queen married, she received territories that were hers to administer, not the king's. She controlled taxation, justice, and settlement rights within those lands. She needed them more than the French crown needed its Jews, because Flanders had no alternative credit infrastructure.
The French crown could eventually replace Jewish lending with Italian bankers, the Lombards, and that's exactly what happened after 1306. But Flanders in 1210 didn't have that option. Jean's cloth economy would have seized up without Jewish credit, so she built a legal framework that made Jewish communities stakeholders in the commercial success of her cities rather than disposable assets of the crown.
The result is a completely different settlement pattern. Jews in Ghent and Bruges living in urban centers, integrated into commercial life, not segregated into Jewries, synagogues in city centers, Jewish lenders employing Christian servants, which in France would have been a scandal. A queen who funded a bishopric in her dower lands had a direct line to the ecclesiastical authority that might otherwise harass her Jewish tax base.
Two successive female rulers, neither of whom was absorbed into a centralizing monarchy, created a pattern of Jewish settlement that survived into the 14th century. When Jews fled France after 1306, many went to the Low Countries, not because it was closer, but because the legal architecture was already there.
Shaping Jewish lives in practical terms meant setting the interest rate a Jewish lender could charge, determining whether church authorities could arrest Jews without secular permission, collecting the annual Jewish tax that funded the queen's household, and deciding whether to readmit Jewish communities after an expulsion. These are concrete, enforceable economic decisions. They show up in charters and tax registers, not just chronicles.
That pattern starts with the earliest case. Adelaide of Maurienne, born around 1092, died 1154. Wife of Louis VI, mother of Louis VII. She becomes regent in 1147 when Louis VII goes off on the Second Crusade.
Which means she's running the kingdom while her son is off failing to take Damascus. And this is where the Dowerlands lever first becomes visible in the documentary record.
Household economic contracting. Queens needed credit for their own operations, which meant they had direct relationships with Jewish moneylenders that kings often lacked, and intercessionary access, the ability to petition, to negotiate, to broker, all without issuing a single decree.
The effectiveness of all three depended on one variable, whether the queen had independent fiscal resources. Blanche had them, so she could create safe zones. Marguerite had fewer, so she had to work through papal back channels.
The Jewish tax and sens under Adelaide yielded roughly 60 livres per year. That was about 8% of her total dower income. That's not a rounding error. That's a significant revenue stream. The pattern is almost mechanically consistent. Queens protected Jewish communities when Jewish economic networks served the queen's fiscal autonomy. They abandoned them when dynastic or ecclesiastical pressure outweighed the economic benefit.
Sugar, of course, being the architectural visionary behind Saint-Denis and the man who essentially invented Gothic as a political program. Not someone you overrule lightly.
And Adelaide overruled him anyway. Not because she had any particular affection for the Jewish community of Sens. The record is clear on this. She never made any philosophical or theological argument for Jewish protection. She made an economic one. Her household budget depended on that 60 livres. Sugar's restrictions would have cut into her operational funds.
When you've got a centralizing Capetian monarchy absorbing queenly power into the crown, you get 1306. The pattern is set.
Intercession becomes access politics. The mechanisms change their names but not their structure, and the protection they offer is always conditional on the protector's autonomy. She's regent twice. First from 1226 to 1234 when Louis is a child, then again from 1248 to 1252 while he's on the Seventh Crusade. She's arguably the most powerful woman in 13th century Europe.
Her relationship with Jewish communities is deeply contradictory in a way that illustrates the tension at the heart of this whole dynamic. On one hand, she's protecting Jewish moneylenders in Paris and Orléans because the crown is borrowing from them to finance Louis's crusade. She's personally guaranteeing those loans.
Her scholarship on French queens and Jewish communities up to the 1306 expulsion, and on early Dutch Jewry in the late medieval Low Countries, it's the direct intellectual lineage for everything we've been discussing. VanLier.org.il. Her work is well worth seeking out.
The 1306 expulsion gets taught as a king's decree. Philip the Fair needed money. Jews had money. He took it.
This is where the 1234 ordinance comes in. It's a compromise document, and it survives in the registers of the Parlement. Which leaves the question of what happened after 1306. Jews expelled from France fled in every direction, south to Provence, east to the Rhineland, and north to the Low Countries.
Which is a massive squeeze on the lender's margins, but it keeps lending legal. That's the compromise. The church gets a symbolic and real restriction on usury. Blanche gets to keep the credit flowing for the crusade. For another episode, I suspect.
It is, but the short version is yes and no. The charters held through the 14th century in Ghent and Bruges, but the Black Death in the 1340s reset everything. Scapegoating, massacres, the usual medieval horror story. The legal framework survived, but the communities didn't.
The Queen as interest rate regulator. It's not a title that shows up in the history books, but that's effectively what she was doing.
That structural difference between the Capetian heartland and the fragmented lordships becomes crucial here. Blanche in Paris had to negotiate with the church, with the Parlement, with the King's Council. It suggests something about institutional memory in fragmented polities versus centralized ones. When a countess issues a charter, it's a contract between two parties. When a king issues a decree, it's an assertion of will.
Because Champagne wasn't fully integrated into the Capetian domain. Jeanne held it as her own inheritance from her father, Henry I of Navarre. Which brings us back to the core tension. Queens were the best protectors Jewish communities had in medieval France. Not because they were more virtuous than kings. They weren't.
You can see the difference in the documents. Blanche's 1234 ordinance bears the king's seal alongside hers. It's a negotiated royal act. Jean's 1304 Troyes charter is issued under her own seal as Countess of Champagne. She confirms the right of Jewish lenders to charge 3% per week and explicitly exempts them from the royal tale that Philip was levying for his war with Flanders.
Which means she's directly contradicting her husband's fiscal policy. Philip is trying to squeeze every revenue source he can find for the Flemish campaign, and Jean is telling him, "Not from my Jews, not in my lands." That's not intercession. That's territorial jurisdiction.
The practical result was that Jewish communities in Champagne survived longer and under better terms than those in the Old of France. The lesson isn't that queens were good and kings were bad. The lesson is that minority protections are fragile when they depend on individual patrons rather than structural rights.
Let's push this logic further. If the fragmentation of lordship created spaces where queens and countesses could protect Jewish communities, what happens when you remove the king entirely from the equation? And that brings us to the Low Countries.
What Jewish communities needed, what all minority communities need, is a legal architecture that doesn't depend on anyone's balance sheet. Joan of Constantinople, Countess of Flanders from 1205 to 1244, and her sister Margaret II, who ruled from 1244 to 1278. They had full fiscal and jurisdictional authority. No king above them, no parlement to negotiate with.
Philip the Fair didn't need to negotiate with his queen about Jewish policy because he'd absorbed the fiscal functions that made her intercession valuable. The Lombard bankers replaced the Jewish money lenders. The queen's chamber stopped mattering. In exchange, they pay a fixed annual sum of 200 livres to the countess's treasury. That's it. No theological preamble, no ecclesiastical consultation, no reference to the church at all.
Jewish security in medieval Europe was strongest where power was most fragmented, where countesses and dukes and bishops all competed for revenue and Jewish communities could play one patron against another.
The contractual language in Joan's charter is different from anything we see in the Capetian documents. It reads like a business agreement between two parties with mutual obligations. The countess provides protection and market access. That's not a medieval problem. That's a permanent problem.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. That's a direct assertion of secular authority over ecclesiastical jurisdiction. The bishop can't touch her Jewish lenders unless she says so.
Which is unthinkable in Capetian France, where Blanche had to co-sign ordinances with the king and negotiate with her own confessor. Margaret didn't have a confessor with political leverage over her. She was the sovereign. The church in Flanders had to work through her courts, not around them.
This created a fundamentally different settlement pattern. In France, Jewish communities were concentrated in royal towns, Paris, Orléans, Troyes, and they were subject to periodic expulsions and readmissions tied to royal policy shifts. That feels appropriate somehow.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and to Rodney Gilbert for sending in this week's prompt. Rodney, we see you, even if you are an anteater. And they were willing to put formal legal protections in place to get it.
Which brings us to 1306. When Philip IV expels the Jews from France, those communities don't disappear. And the primary destination is the Low Countries. Try not to expel anyone in the meantime.
The expulsion was a king's policy, and the refuge was a countess's policy. The gender dimension isn't symbolic here. It's structural. The places where women ruled directly, not through husbands or sons, but as sovereigns, became the places where Jewish communities could survive a catastrophe engineered by a male monarch.
This created what historians call the second wave of Ashkenazic settlement in the Low Countries, distinct from the earlier Rhineland migration of the 11th and 12th centuries. The post-1306 refugees brought French Jewish customs, French Talmudic traditions, and a different dialect of Western Yiddish into Flanders and Brabant. The communities they formed were smaller than the old Rhineland centers, more integrated into local economies, less ghettoized.
Less ghettoized because the legal framework was different. In the Rhineland, Jewish settlement was governed by imperial charters that oscillated between protection and restriction depending on which emperor was in power. In the Low Countries, the countesses had created a stable contractual model. Fixed tax rates, fixed protections, no arbitrary seizures, no ecclesiastical harassment without secular permission.
You can trace the lineage directly. Joan's 1220 charter sets the template. Margaret's 1242 charter hardens it with the anti-ecclesiastical provision, and when the 1306 refugees arrive, those charters are still in force. The countess's framework outlasted the individual countesses themselves.
Which means the pattern of Ashkenazic settlement in the Low Countries, dispersed, economically integrated, legally stable, was not an accident of geography or a simple extension of Rhineland patterns. It was the product of a specific political configuration, female sovereignty, exercised through charters that treated Jewish communities as economic partners rather than theological problems.
That configuration simply didn't exist in Capetian France. The best a French queen could do was create a buffer, like Jean of Navarre's Champagne, that slowed the king's policy but couldn't ultimately stop it. The moment Jean died, the buffer collapsed and Philip expelled the Jews within a year. That's the analytical thread that ties Adelaide, Blanche, Marguerite, and Jean together. It's not just that they were powerful women near the throne. It's that they each controlled economic levers that were structurally distinct from what kings controlled. Kings levied taxes and made war. Queens managed dower lands, household budgets, and credit networks. And Jewish communities were the place where those two systems met.
The soft power versus hard power distinction collapses when you look at the actual mechanics. Setting an interest rate, collecting Italia Judaeorum, issuing a charter that exempts a community from royal taxation. These are not soft. They're precise, binding, and enforceable. Adelaide's 60 livres a year from Sens wasn't symbolic. It was 8% of her operating budget.
The 1306 expulsion looks different through this lens. It's usually told as Philip IV's decision. The king needed money, the Jews were expendable, the Templars were next. But that narrative erases Jean of Navarre. For years, her dower lands in Champagne had been a structural obstacle to expulsion. Her 1304 Troyes charter explicitly contradicted Philip's fiscal policy. As long as she lived, the king couldn't touch the Jewish communities in her territories without a direct confrontation with his own wife.
Jean dies in 1305. The expulsion comes in 1306. That's not a coincidence. Her death removed the last buffer. Philip could finally do what he'd been moving toward for years, because the one person with both the legal authority and the economic incentive to stop him was gone.
Which brings us to the Low Countries contrast, where women ruled as sovereigns. Joan, Margaret, later Margaret of Burgundy, Jewish communities got formal charters, fixed tax rates, and protection from church interference. Where women influenced but didn't rule, Blanche in Paris, Marguerite in Provence after Louis's death. Jewish communities got conditional protection that depended on the political weather. The difference between sovereignty and influence turns out to be the difference between a charter that outlasts its issuer and a protection that dies with the protector.
The gendered mechanics aren't a side note to the story of medieval French Jewry. They're the infrastructure. The places where female rule was strongest were the places where Jewish settlement was most stable. The moment female rule was removed from the equation, Jean's death in 1305, the infrastructure collapsed.
This framework has legs beyond the 13th century. When you look at Jewish settlement patterns in early modern Poland, Lithuania, or the German principalities, you see the same dynamic recurring. Female rulers using minority communities as economic partners, issuing charters, creating stability. The medieval French queens and Flemish countesses didn't invent the pattern, but they're where you can watch it form in real time, on parchment, with seals and tax figures attached.
The expulsion that everyone remembers was a king's decision. The 2 centuries of viability that preceded it was, in significant part, a queen's achievement. That's not a footnote. That's the story.
That story leaves us with the question of what happens next. The 14th century. Jean dies in 1305, the expulsion hits in 1306, and for nearly 90 years the queen's role as a Jewish protector in France simply vanishes. There's no French queen issuing protection charters between Jean and the readmission under the Estates General in 1394.
The 1394 readmission wasn't driven by a queen at all. It was driven by the Estates General, a representative body, negotiating with Charles VI. The queen, Isabeau of Bavaria, was politically sidelined during that period. So, the structural buffer the queens had provided for 2 centuries was gone, and Jewish communities in France paid the price.
Meanwhile, across the border, the Low Countries pattern continued. Margaret of Burgundy, Countess of Flanders from 1361 to 1384, reissued the protection charters that Joan and Margaret II had established. She wasn't inventing a new framework. She was maintaining one that had already proven durable for over a century.
Which raises the question, is there a direct line from Jeanne of Navarre's death in 1305 to the 1394 expulsion? Not just chronologically, but causally. Jeanne was the last French queen who could use dower lands as a genuine buffer against royal policy. After her, the Capetian monarchy had consolidated too much. The dower lands were still there, but the political space to use them independently had shrunk.
I think the causal chain is real, but it's not a straight line. Jeanne's death removed the immediate obstacle, sure, but the larger shift was structural. The 13th century was the high point of fragmented lordship in France. Champagne, Burgundy, Provence, all had enough autonomy for queens and countesses to act independently. By the 14th century, the monarchy had centralized. The Parlement in Paris had expanded its jurisdiction. The space for a queen to issue a charter that contradicted the king's policy had essentially closed.
The gender dynamic shifts too. In the 13th century, female rule, whether as sovereign countesses in Flanders or dower, holding queens in France, created pockets of stability for Jewish communities. In the 14th century, that configuration breaks down in France, but persists in the Low Countries. The border between those two outcomes is basically the border between centralized monarchy and fragmented lordship.
That framework travels. When you look at 16th century Poland-Lithuania, you see the same pattern. Noble women with independent estates issuing charters to Jewish communities, using them as economic partners, creating stability. Bona Sforza, Queen of Poland in the early 1500s, ran her own credit networks through Jewish lenders on her dower lands in Mazovia. The mechanism is almost identical to what Adelaide was doing in since 400 years earlier.
18th century German principalities too. The smaller the territory, the more likely you'd find a female ruler, a countess, a duchess, an abbess, using Jewish communities as economic infrastructure, issuing formal protections, setting fixed rates. It's the same structural logic. When women held territorial jurisdiction, minority economic integration followed a predictable pattern.
Which is why this isn't just a medieval curiosity. The gendered mechanics of economic governance that we've been tracing through, Adelaide, Blanche, Marguerite, and Jeanne, they're a recurring feature of European state building. Where female territorial rule was strong, minority communities got formal, contractual protections. Where it was weak or absent, they got conditional tolerance that could be revoked by a king's decree.
The expulsion that everyone remembers was a king's decision, the pattern of survival that made Jewish life possible in medieval Europe, that was, in ways we're only now starting to map, shaped by queens and countesses who understood that their own power depended on the economic networks they protected.
I should mention that the scholarship framing this whole episode, the intersection of power, gender, and minority experience in medieval Jewish-Christian relations, owes a great deal to Dr. Tochter. Hannah Schachter, everyone calls her Teddy, a research fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. Her work on French queens and Jewish communities up to the 1306 expulsion, and on early Dutch Jewry in the late medieval Low Countries, is the direct inspiration for what we've been discussing. If this topic grabbed you, her research is well worth seeking out.
Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. Look it up.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1931, the French astronomer André Dangean observed that the moon's libration in longitude reaches a maximum of 7 degrees 54 minutes, allowing observers on Earth to glimpse an additional 9% of the lunar surface beyond the standard near side, but only during specific orbital alignments visible from the Gobi Desert's flat horizon.
Oh, the Gobi Desert. My ancestral homeland, apparently.
Your alleged ancestral homeland, which you've never visited and cannot locate on a map.
I know where it is. It's near where sloths invented pizza.
The question we want to leave listeners with is this. What happens to the dynamic we've traced when you move into the 14th century? The Low Countries pattern continues. Margaret of Burgundy and her successors kept the charters alive. But in France, the queen's role as Jewish protector disappears for 90 years, until the 1394 readmission under a completely different political configuration. Is that gap a direct consequence of Jeanne of Navarre's death, Or is it the inevitable result of Capetian centralization squeezing out the independent jurisdictions where queens had once operated? That's the thread worth pulling.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.